This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, case 243, Zhang Yan's Person Up a Tree, the main case. Master Zhang Yan said to the Sangha, "What if you're hanging by your teeth from a tree on a 1,000-foot cliff, with no place for your hands to hold or for your feet to step on? All of a sudden, someone asks you the meaning of the ancestor coming from India. If you respond, you lose your life. If you don't respond, you don't do justice to the question. At just such a moment, what will you do?" Senior monastic stepped out and said, "Master, let's not talk about being in a tree, but tell me, what happens before climbing the tree?" Zhang Yan burst into laughter. The commentary. Old Master Zhang Yan's words are clearly lethal. The only path through this dualistic dilemma is to die the great death and realize true freedom. How is this accomplished? We should appreciate the fact that the questioner, in asking about the ancestors coming from India, is also hanging from a tree on a 1,000-foot cliff. If you can answer Zhang Yan, you will not only free yourself, but the questioner as well. Master Dogen says, "If we look at this koan with a non-thinking mind, we can attain the same real free samadhi as Zhang Yan and grasp its meaning even before he's opened his mouth." What is this non-thinking mind? Setting aside Zhang Yan, the tree, and the cliff, you tell me, what is the meaning of the ancestor coming from India? If you open your mouth to answer, you've missed it. If you don't open your mouth, you're 1,000 miles from the truth. Senior monastic Hu Tao makes it clear, in the tree, below the tree, before the tree, and after the tree, it's all dirt from the same hole. The commentary, the verse. Where affirmation and negation merge, there it is, alone and revealed. On the solitary mystic peak, the Blue Mountains have not a single speck of dust. So this morning we're concluding an introductory retreat. So we've been, you know, thinking about how a person might first encounter Buddhism, and then they narrow that down to some particular lineage or tradition, and then they might turn towards the path. They might seek out training or practice in a practice center. And then it's just you, just other people, just the world, just this life. And this koan, like really every teaching, every practice, everything that the Dharma is asking, what is it? How to live it? How to be free of suffering? How to manifest compassion? How to be a benefit? How is this accomplished? This case also appears in the Gateless Gate. And there it starts out, it's like you're hanging in a tree by your teeth. What's like? Don't you know? Haven't you yourself hung from this tree by your teeth with no place to hold, no foot to stand on? Dada Roshi quotes Master Dogen, who says, in essence, we're all hanging from a branch by our teeth. The world is filled with so many things: people, creatures, situations, languages, ethnicities, colors, preferences, beliefs, desires, religions, no religions. And in the midst of all of it, one way of saying it is that we seek connection. Ultimately, we seek unity. The medicine to address the sense of distance and separation that creates endless complications in a world where there are so many differences. Here's one. Dr. Rushi says the only path through this dualistic dilemma is to die the great death, the spiritual death, and realize real freedom. How is this accomplished? How do we do this? So I've spoken many times about duality, which is an ordinary word. It means two. It's used a lot in Buddhism, and in that way, it can sound academic or philosophical, sort of abstract, and it's really important to appreciate that it's talking about living in a world of differences that we perceive as different. We come into practice with a deep belief in the self. I am. I am someone. You are. You are someone. We are not the same. We are two. But it's deeper than a belief. A belief is something that we think about, can speak about, can have ideas and opinions about, can argue about, and that sits in the surface, relatively speaking, in the surface of our mind. And beliefs come and go as things change. But this is deeper than that. This is something that permeates our bones. It flows through our bloodstream. It's in your toenails. It's in every hair follicle. It's so integrated that we don't see it as something. And that's the greatest challenge of all. It's in our conscious mind. Right now, you're sitting in the zendo. Right now, you're listening to a talk. All of these moments, one after another, not just includes you, but from that deep belief in a separate self, puts you right at the center. And the universe then revolves around. But it exists in a much, much deeper way, too. Deeper than our conscious mind, in aspects of our consciousness that we can't directly touch. And so Buddhist practice has to be extremely skillful in terms of how to reach into those deepest aspects of our consciousness that you can't directly access. Our senses perceive inside and outside, self and other, differences, and our society and our culture gives those differences meaning. And on the basis of that meaning, we create heaven and we create all kinds of hells. What do things mean? What does skin color mean? What does gender mean? What does a belief mean? What does your economic status mean? What does it mean to be a parent? What does it mean not to be a parent? What does it mean to live here or there? And all together, this creates what we call our identity, our self. Who am I? What catalog, what list would you give someone if they said, who are you? And so because it's so much deeper than a belief, we can't just decide, okay, I'm not going to believe in this anymore. Done. I'm free. Not quite. Because it's not a willful thing. It's so integrated that we don't even see how we are actively creating, perpetuating, maintaining, fighting for, upholding. And so while intention, desire plays an extremely important role in Buddhist practice, it alone is not enough. And so Dada Roshi says to die the spiritual death, which means to die too, which really means just to see through the illusion of this deep-seated belief, of the belief. And the experience of this personal self, which really means the imputed meaning of the self. What does it mean to be me? What does it mean to be you? And so we have a path. We train, we have a practice, we encounter the Dharma, we study it, we reflect on it, we practice, we actualize it. And within those words is our worlds and worlds of moments of experience, of study and examination, of letting go, of holding on, of stepping forward and turning backwards, of leaping and dying. The Buddha said, everything that comes into being appears for a moment and then passes, dies. And so we let go of our desires, of pleasure and pain, of existence, and of non-existence. Buddhism teaches that these are the three essential desires that we cling to. Pleasure and pain, attraction and denial, which preoccupies so much of our attention in the early years, which means many, of practice. And that is some of the most difficult, but in the big picture, actually, some of the easiest part of the training. Because it's in your face, it's demanding attention. You respond and there's result. Not always the way you want, but there's you see the results of you, and you can access it, you see it. You feel it, you hear it, you taste it. But how do you reach into that much deeper aspect of existence, which is really both the ocean from which arises our suffering and our liberation? And so Master Zhangyan said, what if you were hanging by a tree from your teeth? By your teeth. You can't reach anything by your hands. Your feet can't rest anywhere. What if? So the koan is, in this case, Master Zhangyan is creating a dream. Is creating a fantasy. What if? And Buddhism really is dreaming ourselves awake. That this monastery, Buddhist practice, teachings, liturgy, all the things that we have been doing this morning are creations. We construct these things. They didn't just exist. We create them, and we create them every day. Well, if we're trying to free ourselves of illusions, then why are we doing so much production? To dream ourselves awake, to awaken ourselves from the dream, from within the dream. And so then we can move within the dream, which is the constantly arising appearance of things in your senses, knowingly, wakefully. And so Zhangyan gives us such a dream. What if you were hanging by a tree by your teeth? And Dogen says, the passage that Dadaroshi is quoting, if we enter the heart of this case by taking up not thinking and beyond thinking, we can have the experience of sharing a cushion with old man Zhangyan. More than a cushion, you can merge with his mind, see through his eyes. And so Zazen is to do just that, to sit on this cushion. Not your personal cushion, but the cushion of the Buddha, the cushion of every enlightened being. The same seat. Take the same posture. Turn into the same mind. And allow that karmic mind, that personal mind, that so very busy mind, that mind that puts us up in the tree with nothing to hold on to, allow that mind to come fully to rest. No more producing, not creating, not wanting, not denying the natural order of mind. And so Zhangyan is purposefully bringing us to the edge. There's so much in life that is uncomfortable, unsettling, disturbing. And then we come into Buddhist practice with promises of wisdom and compassion, of peace and liberation. And what we experience is disturbances. more. New, never dreamt of. Didn't know were possible. Have spent our whole life avoiding. And Buddhism does this very purposefully. The analogy is you go to a doctor with an illness and the doctor says, oh, don't worry about it. Just go home, turn on the TV, just forget all about it. Or you go to another doctor and that doctor says, oh my God, and collapses in a heap of tears and moans and groans, right? You don't want to go to either of these doctors, right? You go to another doctor who says, yes, I've seen this before. It will take some work. First, you have to understand the illness, its cause. And then you have to know that it's curable. You can heal this. And then you have to undergo treatment, take some medicine. And so Zhangyan is giving us all of this. Just like every evening, let me respectfully remind you, life and death is supreme importance. And all of it is to bring us closer, to remind us what we shouldn't forget, to wake us up from our sleep, to turn us towards what's true. You know, it's interesting, we can, at so many times in our life, seem lost and confused. That was certainly true for me. And then I realize and remember moments in early times of training when I felt lost and confused. And then I thought, but wait, it's not like it was before. Because I'm in the midst of a practice. I have a path. Within this sense of being lost and confused, I actually know what I need to do reasonably well. Well enough. I have a practice. It's not the same lost. It's not the same confused. So, Dada Roshi says, how is this accomplished? We could ask, how do we not squander our lives? Hanging from this tree by our teeth, someone comes below and says, what is the meaning of the ancestor coming from India? This is a question that appears again and again in the teachings of Zen, which is really asking, what is the fundamental truth? What is this Dharma? What is liberation? What is it that I have forgotten that I so want to remember? If we tried to enter this from the dualistic dilemma, then what we find is me, in the tree, the branch, nothing to hold on to, 1,000 feet below, empty space, hard ground. You, below, asking this question, my life, your life, the risks involved, the possible rewards. Two paths, a dilemma. Which do I take? Which is the right one? To save my life means I turn my back to you. To attend to your needs means I lose my life. What do I do? Clinging to the self, this dualistic dilemma is born. And what the Buddha realized in his enlightenment is there's another road. The gate is open. What is self-clinging? What is to be free of self-clinging? As this koan makes abundantly clear, the Dharma doesn't answer your questions. It doesn't solve our problems. It doesn't take care of you. It doesn't ensure your well-being. It's not a thing. It doesn't exist somewhere. It's not a department of enlightenment with a chief. It's got their hands on a master control. Dharma is basic reality of things, of you, of me, of everything. It's the perfect embodiment of that reality. It's how that reality functions in perfect accord within this universe. This universe itself is that very reality. It's the path that we can take, this path, to practice and realize that reality. It belongs to no one. You cannot possess it. It doesn't help you. It's not like something. Because it doesn't belong to anyone, it reaches everywhere. It's always available. Because it can't be possessed, it's always can be practiced. It's never lost. Because it can't help you, you don't have to wait for a thing. Don't wait. And because it's not like something, you're already standing on the ground of reality. You meet it everywhere. Dogen says, what is grasping the branch? Oh, he says, what is grasping the branch are the teeth. Thus, the entire teeth are the branch. The entire branch is the teeth. The whole body is the mouth. The whole mouth is the whole body. He's using language. He's exploding language. He's undomesticating language to meet undomesticated reality. He's speaking from a place of no division. Again, when we enter by thinking, then there's my teeth holding on to the branch. There's the branch that I'm holding on to with my teeth. There's my hands, which can't reach anything. There's my feet that can't rest anywhere. So many things that are not working together. So many things that are problematic and that are separate. The entire teeth of the branch, entire means all over the body. Whole means throughout the body. Body means throughout all time and space. Zazen is this. All of practice is this. Every human being doesn't just want to live a purposeful life. Nobody wants to live a meaningless life. But underlying that, isn't it that we all want to be life? We want to experience our life as a unified, vibrant, alive aliveness. Not just a bunch of pieces that we assemble on a board and hope no one kicks it over. Not just a lot of things that we have to do every day. We want a sense of cohesion, of coherency, of that all of this is about something. All of this is something. And that must be true within a world that is constantly changing, within a house that is on fire, within impermanence, where you don't get to keep anything. I want to read again this passage from Dogen's Undivided Activity that I spoke of last weekend because it's so good. Quietly think over whether life and all things that arise together with life are inseparable or not. Is it really just a bunch of disparate pieces? Are we just a collection of odd forms, bodies, moving through space, colliding, sometimes coming together? Quietly think over this. There's neither a moment nor a thing that is apart from life. He speaks from that ground of reality. He speaks from a place of direct knowing. There is neither an object nor a mind that is apart from life. Life is just like riding in a boat. You raise the sails and off you go, steering the boat. And although you steer the sail and the pole, the boat gives you the ride. And without the boat, no ride. But you ride in the boat, and your riding makes the boat what it is. examine this moment. At just such a moment as this, there is nothing but the world of the boat. That's the world. But what is that world? Dogen says, the sky, the water, the shore, the fish, the clouds, the rain, the thunder, the lightning. All of it is the boat's world, which is not the same as having a world that does not belong to the boat. Thus, you make your life what it is. You make life your life. And so there we are in the tree. There's me, there's the branch, there's the tree, there's a 1,000-foot cliff, there's the ground below, there's the person asking the question, there's their question, their life, my life, all the world of the boat. Here, in this tree, I ride the boat. I steer, I sail. This is the experience of my life. This is what I call my life. This is what I call my world. And they're not two. Zhangyan presents us with what seems obviously two different worlds. I'm riding in one boat, you're riding in another boat. That's why Dadarishi says, the only way through this dilemma, and the dilemma is two, is to die. To die to that way of seeing things, which is not just a matter of will. It's not just, okay, I'm not going to see things that way. I'm going to see things as unified. That just doesn't cut it. But this is not to say that you can be everywhere at once, that you can solve every problem, that you can escape every pain. But it is to say that there is an undivided life. There is within us our very nature. When realized, we see the world that Dogen is describing. We see the world that Zhangyan is presenting us as a moment, not as a dualistic dilemma. There is a life that is free of suffering, and that exists within the world of a multitude of creatures and circumstances. Dogen goes on to say, when you ride in a boat, your body and mind and the world around you together are the undivided activity. They are not a dilemma. So that raises the question, in the moment when we are facing a dilemma, what are we doing with our mind? What have we put outside of the boat? What division have we created? What other world is there? The entire earth and the entire sky are both the undivided activity of the boat. Thus, life is nothing but you, you are nothing but life, and nothing is excluded. Now, for this koan to have real power, you, the one who is hanging by your teeth, has to actually give a damn about the person on the ground. That's the key. If you don't care, then all of this is just, I don't know, more of the same. Caring about that person is the door. That's what makes it real. It's understood that you care about your life, right? That doesn't have to be stated. You care about your life. But we have to actually care about the person on the ground so that we are facing this stark reality. So that not doing justice to the question is an understatement. It's that if I disregard you, if I don't attend to your needs, I turn against your life. I turn away from your life. And not only is your life suffering, but my life suffering because it's just one boat. The question comes up, and it's not a new question. It's actually a very, very old question. And one way of asking it is, Buddhism political? Should Buddhism and Buddhists get involved in worldly things? Injustice, justice, inequality, equality, poverty, war, environmental crisis, racial injustice, gender injustice, all of the suffering of our world. Should Buddhism and practitioners and Dharma centers get involved? I looked up political, and it says, relating to or affecting interests of status or authority within an organization rather than matters of principle. I thought that was kind of interesting. Rather than matters of principle. And so Buddhism is clearly established as being concerned about matters of principle, right? The fundamental thing. Life, death, suffering, impermanence, human consciousness, human impact, karma. Those fundamental things that every human being carries within them, whether they give them attention or not. And so it has always been a contemplative practice, turning inward, right? The revolution, because everyone knows how to turn outward. Everyone has to learn how to navigate the world, how to take care of things. And so it's turning the light around. It's sitting on this cushion. It's having time to do that. It's doing that within communities, which means we have to go to those places where people are gathering. Which means we have to create a place where we can gather. And then we have to take care of that place that we've created so we can gather. And so it becomes something. And this started in the time of the Buddha. And in that way, we encourage harmonious living. And in order to do that, we have to quiet the storms of our mind. Right? Because otherwise, we just continue to dwell within our own turmoil, which then merges with the turmoil of the world, and then there's just turmoil. And so that has to calm, that has to rest. And so within sanghas, there's always a practice of creating circumstances that are conducive to calming your mind. And we do that coming from a world which seems in many ways designed to do exactly the opposite, to create turbulence, turmoil, agitation, unrest within the mind and body and emotions and thinking. And so within a community like this, we create a certain place that is helping to calm that agitation by not introducing lots of agitation. Right? And there are periods of time where you step away, like a weekend like this, or like Sesshin, or people coming into residency. But then, of course, we meet a lot of turmoil and agitation and disturbance within ourselves, which is exactly why it's so important to create an environment that is less externally tumultuous, so we can really see in more stark relief the self arising. And so that's Buddhism. That's Buddhist practice. That's what it's been for all of these years. And for all of those years, that's been happening within countries and nations and times of change and unrest and war and peace and poverty and famine and good times. And so what about that? What's the relationship? What should the relationship be? For much of Buddhism's history, monastic communities, which was really the heart of where Buddhist practice was really happening, were reliant on patrons, wealthy people, people with money. And those communities then, of course, had to have a favorable relationship with those people with money who wanted to donate that money and help support that community. Well, we know what that creates, right? Right? You have to please, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. It's pretty simple. And so there were built-in constraints on what Buddhist communities could do. But even if those weren't there, is that the role of a Buddhist community? Is that the role of Buddhist practice? And this is a very live thing. And I'm sure even in this room, there's a spectrum of feelings about this. People come here, lay practitioners come here from a lot of, you know, disturbance and chaos and inundation of news and information and concern or numbness and want to find a refuge for a weekend, for a week, for a month. And to be able to turn one's attention, right, without so much competition. But what is the role of a Dharma community, of a practice community? Right. We have obviously done a lot of things to establish exactly that kind of environment that I've been describing. We do session every month. We're in training every week of the year. Right? We have a little bit of time off the schedule in which practice is encouraged strongly to continue. You know, bodhisattvas don't really take time off, right? So when you're up in the tree, you're like, sorry, I'm on vacation, right? You just caught me at a bad time. That doesn't mean that there's no relaxation, but there's true relaxation. So what is our role here? What does this mean to you? What does it mean to, how do we navigate this within our community? So we have an Earth Initiative that is devoted to addressing the inflicted wounds and crises that we have put upon our earth. We have the National Buddhist Prison Sangha. We work in a very intensive way with people who are incarcerated. We have the Beyond Fear of Differences work, which is trying to eliminate, to heal racial injustice, gender injustice, and particularly within those of us who are responsible historically, who have received legacies, inheritances, have benefits that are based on the oppression of other people. We have recently created and brought forth a Dharma in Action where we've asked the Sangha to step in and really to move into those areas that people, the Sangha is interested in, where there is suffering, and how do we alleviate that suffering? And so are we here to liberate the suffering of ourselves so that we can live freely? That takes time and energy. We have to be able to do this. We have to be able to practice every day. We have to walk a path. And that's just not a theoretical thing. It's a time and space thing. Are we here to liberate the suffering of others and be of benefit to the world? We chant those vows every day. Many of us have taken vows. There's a difference. Taken vows to live our lives that way. If we don't free ourselves of attachments and self-clinging, then how are we going to help others if we're caught in the same cycles of suffering that we're trying to address? And so we need to stop, turn around, see, free ourselves. If we don't turn to the suffering of the world, then how will we, what kind of practice do we have? What do those vows mean? If we don't turn in, how can we actually truly experience and free ourselves of the suffering, which means we have to see through that dualistic dilemma? When you ride in a boat, your body and mind and the environment together are the undivided activity of the both. Nothing is excluded. And for most of Buddhism's history, certainly in the Mahayana, this has been taught with the utmost sincerity, the utmost earnestness. This is a reporting from that ground of reality. But it has not historically been brought out. It has. It's not that, you know, engaging the world and addressing suffering hasn't been part of Buddhism. It has since the beginning. But in the way that is happening in the West, and can happen, because most centers are self-supporting. And so how do we understand this dilemma? Do I turn in? Do I turn out? Do I take care of my practice? Do I take care of you? Do I care about you? What is taking care of anyway? These are very real questions. And they're not questions that we just answer and it's like, okay, we figured that out. They're living questions. They're the best kind of questions. They're the questions that irritate you, right? Because they're difficult not to solve. They're difficult to live. Because there are so many situations just like this. And it's so easy to just step into that dualistic view where it's like, okay, well, is it me or you? And that's the great imperative of Buddha Dharma, is to leap free of that. See how much larger we are. See how much more is possible. And understand this and live this in a real place, in a real world. That's why I said it doesn't mean that if you realize enlightenment and realize the non-duality of all things, that you will become like, you know, a superhero. You will go out and catch every person before they fall. Right? You will stop every injustice before it occurs. It's a real world. And so it doesn't tell us what to do. It doesn't answer those difficult questions. But it introduces us to our actual original nature. It helps us to see and understand the inner workings of things. That's why Dada Roshi says, where affirmation and negation merge, there it is, alone and revealed. We see that things are not opposed to each other. Opposition only and can only exist in our consciousness. We, through the meaning that we impute into things, create divisions and boundaries, highs and lows. When Master Hu Tao says, let's not talk about being in a tree. Talk to me about what happens before you climb the tree. And Zhang Yan bursts into laughter, alone and revealed. His laughter is not lighthearted. His laughter is an expression of being free of this dualistic dilemma. Has he resolved it for the person in the tree? Has he addressed the person on the ground? That's what each of us has to see. He opens the road for us to enter, free of entrapment, that this is the right way or this is the wrong way. This is for me, this is for you. As Dogen says, really, what Zhang Yan wants is that each of us should dare to respond. That each of us should dare to respond. That each of us should care about the person on the ground, and the tree, and the branch, and the sky, the whole world that is the world of the boat. And when we sit down and do this by numbers, you know, create a spreadsheet, it's just flat out going to knock you on your butt. It's just overwhelming, right? And that perspective is true. It's true. And there is another road. There is another way in. To understand that is free of the dualistic dilemma. You know, it's like what we find out, like we come into practice and we want to experience the ground of reality, and all along the way we keep thinking, wait a minute, this is more reality than I had in mind. Right? I had a very nice portrait of reality that I was looking for. Nobody's life turns out the way you thought. Nobody's practice turns out the way we thought, and that's the good news. It's so much larger. It's so much better. So, a living question to live with, to practice with, to be disturbed by, to care about. It's asking a lot. But that's because that's who we are. We are that person.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.